The following has been brought to you despite great danger. Please listen and heed the warning within. Godspeed and safe listening.
Good evening, my name is Shooter Jennings, and in 2010 I released an album called Black Ribbons. It featured the master of horror, Stephen King, as Will-o'-the-Wisp, a radical radio show host who was hopelessly clinging on during his final night of broadcast before public airwaves were restricted to government-approved transmissions. In this show, we're going to delve into some of the great stories and tales that inspired Black Ribbons. Welcome to Beyond the Black. Episode 3. Everything else is illusion. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen of the night. I'd like to take a moment to thank all of you for the overwhelmingly positive feedback and response we've gotten from Beyond the Black. Initially, I set out to make this a platform to dig deeper into some of the larger pictures that inspired my album Black Ribbons, but it's really taken on a life of its own and begun to become something bigger and more dangerous than that. This is really becoming a dream of mine. I always wanted to be a talk radio host, and as I said in past episodes, I grew up on Art Bell and his late night radio show, Coast to Coast AM, as well as films and books like Talk Radio and The Night Listener. The concept of sitting in a small room late at night while talking to a faceless audience has always excited me. It has inspired me. I was lucky enough that in early 2006, I was given the opportunity to host a music-driven radio show called Electric Rodeo. It's on Sirius XM Channel 60 Outlaw Country, if you guys haven't heard it yet. It airs Saturdays, Sundays, and Thursday. You can find out more information on that at ShooterJennings.com, but it's still going to this day, 10 years later. In regards to the album, though, I really have to give credit where credit is due. Black Ribbons would have never happened if it hadn't have been for my radio show. There's something about the experience of doing a radio show, programming a playlist, discussing topics, connecting with the invisible audience that is there but I can't see, all those things that go into doing my radio show. They gave me the idea to do and the insight to grasp the concept of something like Last Light Radio and the character of Will-o'-the-Wisp. If you don't know who I'm talking about, I'm referring to Will-o'-the-Wisp, the character that stitches together the music on my 2010 album, Black Ribbons. On Election Day this year, my label, Black Country Rock, is releasing the Black Ribbons Ultimate Edition, which will include two LPs, two CDs, and over 6 hours of exclusive extras, including the full Beyond the Black audio series. But that feeling of listening to radio, even radio theater, has always been my favorite. Albums and music are theater of the mind, or at least they were before MTV came into play. I love the idea of closing your eyes and drifting off into another world, letting your thoughts and your imagination, your experiences, and your relationships direct the personal movie in your mind. Much like reading a book is different and provides a more personal experience than watching a film or television adaptation, only hearing something and not seeing it gives an experience unlike anything else in the world. All those neurons and synapses in your brain work overtime to create a world that has no bounds, no limitations. It can be very romantic. It can be very exciting. And like other things, it can also be very dangerous. Your darkest demons might be tempted to come out that way as well. Something that might be fairly benign to someone else might conjure up images of the most ferocious monster in your mind. The darkest demon that might have been hiding undisturbed since childhood might just open his eyes and pop out and strike when the right song or even the right sentence summons it. This is why I love talking about the darkest untouchable secrets in the world. I am not afraid to touch on them. I just hope you are not afraid to go there. Everything else is illusion.
Dimensional, intellectual, ghost and physical. West Coast perfection ain't blowing Mexican cross connected. It's inspiration, host of hosts. Can't see, can't touch.
So you're saying as you dig deeper, you find computer code writ in the fabric of the cosmos. It's not just sort of resembles computer code, you're saying it is computer code.
According to mainstream science, the electromagnetic spectrum is just 0.005% of what exists in the universe. Mm. Visible light, which is the only frequency band that we can see in a world that we perceive, is a fraction of the 0.005%. And even within that sliver of visible light, this planet, compared with the size of the universe, is equivalent to a billionth of a pinhead. Do you think there could be other life other than humans?
I do.
Man is a spiritual being. He is not a piece of flesh. And when you begin to handle man on the basis that he is a spirit, that he has unlimited ability, and then we try to improve that capability, in that way, we win.
The title of the fifth song on Black Ribbons is directly taken from David Icke's book titled Infinite Love is the Only Truth, Everything Else is Illusion. As I mentioned in the first episode, David Icke was really the touchstone which lit the fire that inspired Black Ribbons. Well, he and Blue Oyster Cult, to try and cure my fever with cowbell, you know. Together, hand in hand, they formed the initial ideas that would result in the dystopian concept record Black Ribbons. Blue Oyster Cult's Greatest Hits was the only album I had on hand while I drove across country, and late night radio was my only foreign companion. Late one night, while listening to Art Bell, David Icke was the guest for all 4 hours. This was during a time when the economy was in full collapse. Poor lending practices and shady business had put the big banks in a lurch, and the people were hurting everywhere. David Icke is a radical idealist. He's a controversial writer and a speaker who is still making his rounds and preaching his gospel. He started out as a pretty well-respected footballer and then a sportscaster in Britain. But he had an awakening moment and it changed his whole life trajectory, if you will. He's a ton of fun to dig into if you can keep an open mind. He has quite a few books out there. Another one's called The Biggest Secret. We're going to dig into The Biggest Secret a lot later in the series, too. But it delves much into the reptilian bloodline theory and world agenda, which digs deep into the globalist agenda. And it made a surprisingly high number of predictions, which, regardless if you buy the reptilian factor, are delivered with razor-sharp accuracy. But the focus of tonight's show is about the world of illusion we live in and how deep it might possibly go. While he was speaking at Recode's Code Conference, Elon Musk recently stated, "There's a billion-to-one chance we're living in base reality." He went on to discuss the fact that odds are we are living in a simulation, a video game for another civilization. He said, if you assume any rate of improvement at all, then games will become indistinguishable from reality. Even if that rate of advancement drops by 1,000 from what it is now, let's just imagine it's 10,000 years in the future, which is nothing on the evolutionary scale. If a civilization stops advancing, then that may be due to a calamitous event that erases civilization. Either we're going to create simulations that are indistinguishable from reality, or civilization will cease to exist. Now, you really have to step outside of your programmed reality to even grasp this concept. But it's not the first time it's been presented in our world. The 1999 science fiction film The Matrix really brought this idea to pop culture. But it's not something that is really that far-fetched if you look at the way the world is built and presented to us. What if we are all living in a false reality, fully controlled and conducted by someone else, possibly a far advanced race of dungeon masters or even a malevolent force? This is a concept that goes back as far as Plato, with his allegory of the cave in René Descartes' Evil Demon. Are we simply prisoners chained up to a cave watching shadows on a wall? Or even a brain in a vat with some malicious demon controlling what we see and know as our world? I think the best way to discuss this without starting too far outside of our grasp of human consciousness is to start from where we are right now and what we are and build outward. We're human beings. We know this, or at least we've been told this in the books we've read in school by others around us. In all of the major mainstream religions, we're told that there is some kind of superior being or beings, God, Allah, or whoever you may serve or revere. But the earth has always been described as a large petri dish of growing specimens made in the likeness of an omnipotent and often jealous overlord. If we let our master down and don't follow his or her rules, we're punished, or at least we're made to fear the punishment that may be handed down if we don't live by those laws set to govern us. Yes, as we've discussed before, the purpose of religion seems, or at least to me, to institute a series of moral codes so that we may be able to live in a civilized and overall good society. But the concept of a god, even with angels and all that, it really changes the image of what the world is. To more of like, a large ant farm, if you will. And we're being observed from on high and judged based on our successes and failures. We're wandering aimlessly through the tunnels of life, while those who are above us are watching and silently making notes and making our scorecard. There are some folks that feel like they are in direct contact with God. My mother was raised in a Pentecostal church. Her mother, Helen, was a preacher at that church, and my mom and her brothers and sisters participated there. Now, like I've said, I am a spiritual person. I was raised that way. My mother encouraged me to read the Bible and to understand the messages hidden inside. She believes in her direct relationship with God in a stronger way than I have ever experienced with anyone before. It has always been equal parts fascination and admiration with me, and it's also been equal parts terrifying when my own doubt takes center stage. Although some people, like my mother, have a deeply personal connection with God, what about the others? As far as I know, no one on earth has actually come in physical contact with God, or Allah, or the Supreme Being. Faith is built upon a concept that believing without seeing is the goal that lines the road to spiritual harmony. What if God is just a 10-year-old kid playing his extremely advanced simulation game, and we're all Sims in a large Sim-Earth game, somewhere in the distant future? Through the eons, each generation is born into a way of life that was taught them from their previous generation. Each part of the world throughout history has had multiple gods, sometimes hundreds of gods, presented as reality. Creation tales span vast concepts and realities. The Navajo Indians had a creation story called Dene Bahane, which read, "Of a long ago these things are said. It is said that white arose in the east and was considered day. We now call that spot place where the waters crossed. Blue arose in the south. It too was considered day. So the spirit who already lived there moved around. We would call them air spirit people in the language spoken today by those who are given the name Balagana, which means white man. In the west, yellow arose and showed that evening had come. And then in the north, black arose. So the air spirit people lay down and slept." Now that's from the book Dene Bahane, the Navajo creation story, translated and edited by Paul G. Zalbrod. The Navajo creation myth spans over 250 pages. From a great article on ancient-origins.net, Mark Miller has laid out a lot of the terrifying creation stories that have formed the basis of many of our ancient societies. Here are a few for you to chew on. A tomb of Egypt, the not-yet-completed one who will attain completion, and dwelt in the primordial depths, masturbated to create the father and mother of the earth and sky. Namu is the Sumerian mother ancestress who gave birth to all the gods. Marduk of Babylon sliced up the body of the terrible monster Tiamat and formed all of creation from her corpus. The Persians had two gods, Ahura Mazda, who fashioned all the positive on earth, and Ahriman, who fashioned all the negative. This is still believed in by Zoroastrians. In Jewish Kabbalah, the aged of the aged, the unknown of the unknown, the truth of all truths, form without form, the uncreated uncreating, has an unblinking face, Makroposopos, always seen in profile. And on it is the blinking face of the uncreated creating, the Mikroposopos. Joseph Campbell described them in his book, A Hero with a Thousand Faces. Campbell said that Kabbalists believe Makroprosopos is the I Am of the Old Testament, and the Mikroprosopos is the name of God. Many of these often feel like they're describing some sort of interaction from the universe, and it isn't necessarily a big man with a white beard on a cloud clapping his hands, making the universe. There even are some far-fetched theories that say that Freemasons in the 33rd degree supposedly disclose the concept that they believe that we came from a UFO of sorts, that space people interacted with Earth and put us here, and that race continues as our true creators. Either way, who is right? Do we have any proof? Is there any way of proving it? Is this really what drives us in many ways to explore the universe? It does seem that everyone wants to know where we came from and why we're here. To find out where you're going, you need to know where you've been. Yes, evolution makes sense, and the deeper we dig, the more questions arise. But as I said earlier, let's back it on down to the ground to our basic lives. It's the 21st century. Most of you, like me, were born into a world that's very basic. Money is the foundation of trade, and we need it to support ourselves and our families. Jobs are how we make said money, and the money we spend is going to secure a strong economy for all of us to live in. One that produces products and services, not to mention the nourishment we all need to survive. The education system allows for us to learn how to function in the world before we're unleashed upon it. They teach us to fit in and accept the reality that our fathers and our mothers and their mothers before them accepted. And they became a part of it, and they survived, or at least they attempted to survive. This system has been like its own race, deftly evolving from the birth of time, from simple tools and services to a profoundly complex and advanced global civilization. In a phenomenon called the 100th monkey effect, that has been discredited by some, but researchers watched as one monkey would pick up a new trait or habit that would help them. Slowly, it would be adopted among the population of monkeys. And once the critical number, or the 100th monkey, was reached, it spread by unexplained means to all the populations. It spread immediately to them even if they weren't in contact with these monkeys. The theory helps support archetypal psychology. As even though there may be flaws seen in the original research, it is something you can see all around us, but more importantly, with ideas. The internet makes our world smaller. Our societal evolution can both be stifled and accelerated. All the monkeys have to do is get on Twitter or Facebook, and ideas, the good and the bad, they can spread like STDs in a small town. Yes, parts of the world are far and away behind the good old US of A in many areas. Hey, some are even primitive, but as the Earth evolves, everything moves with it. I guess we're still waiting for some of those 100th monkeys. But the idea here is to try and step away from what you know and accept as reality and question everything. Who says that we have to live in a capitalist society? Many have tried for socialism, and in some cases it has worked to a point. But it's hard to stifle the nature of the human race to strive to do something other than settling and sharing. Often, our dominant traits of greed, selfishness, and innovation will win. And as much of a stigma as they carry, they're not all bad. But the concepts and cornerstones are still the same as they are now. We are taught to accept the box that we live in with the name that we're given and the job that we should take and not question a damn thing. If you turn against the system in place, you're a nut job. If you change the system in place, you're a revolutionary. People often falsely attribute Gandhi with saying the following: first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they attack you, then you win. There's not been much proof that he actually said this, but a fellow by the name of Nicholas Klein gave a quote that's pretty similar to it when he addressed the Amalgamated Clothing Workers of America in Baltimore in 1918. His actual quote was, "First they ignore you, then they ridicule you, then they attack you and want to burn you, and then they build monuments to you. And that is what's going to happen to the Amalgamated Clothing Workers of America." This to me has always stood out. This is how any kind of revolution happens. It all starts by questioning what's put in front of you to accept and finding a better way. On top of the little box that we're made to accept with our little names, which somehow mean something, with our little reputations that are somehow to provide for us and walk before us into a room, with our little bank account that somehow explains how successful we are. It's all bullshit, folks. It's all numbers on a little scorecard that never existed to begin with. Again, love is the only truth. The only thing that you can do that actually does anything for the world is enrich the lives of someone else at your own expense. Everything else is illusion. A prop set up to keep the rich rich and the poor poor, separating the masters from the servants, building the immense castle upon the mountain, and keeping all the peasants hungry so they'll kill each other. just to get ahead in life. We keep rounding around this point, but Black Ribbons is built on this point. Take away all the illusions. Wrap your head around a harmonious existence. It's almost complete fiction at this point. John Lennon said it best in Imagine. I know you all know that song and probably didn't need a refresher course, but what he's saying is imagine a world of love without the illusion of power. Every man is equal. Your riches are your power, your possessions are your accomplishments. They don't mean anything when it boils down to it. There ain't no bacon hell, or you can't take it with you, as I've heard by many old timers over the course of my life. Now let's add to our simulation that we're living in. We've got the rules, we've been taught what success means, we've been thrown into a machine and turned loose and greased the wheels just as we've been told. Now let's dip into the next layer, public perception in the mob mentality or the herd mentality. Most of you know L. Ron Hubbard as the science fiction writer and the creator of the Church of Scientology, but not as many people know about a manuscript he wrote prior to writing his definitive novel and handbook, Dianetics. Excalibur, or The Dark Sword, as it was called, is a manuscript that was rumored to have driven the few people who set eyes upon it to insanity, and in some cases, even suicide. While this may be just romanticization of Hubbard's own myth, the manuscript itself has a quite intriguing history. Apparently, in the 1930s, L. Ron had a near-death experience which inspired the writing of the manuscript. By the 50s, Mr. Hubbard had put a limited number of copies of Excalibur up for sale for $1,500 each, which was a ton of dough back then. He cautioned it with ads that the first 15 people who read the manuscript went insane and promised that it contained data never to be released during Mr. Hubbard's stay on Earth. They even made the readers sign a contract that said they wouldn't hold L. Ron Hubbard or the publishing company responsible if they went insane. Hubbard even wrote a letter to John F. Kennedy telling him that he believed that Excalibur had been stolen by the Soviets after he refused their offer of $100,000 and a laboratory to continue his work. Who knows? JFK might have been interested in the letter, but he probably was too busy with Mimi Alford even to see it. Remember her? Hubbard said that in his near-death experience that his heart must have stopped beating and he slipped through the curtain and into the land of shade. In an account from his publisher, Forrest J. Ackerman, he says that L. Ron described the experience as Hubbard finding himself hovering outside of his own body and feeling drawn into the great ornate, as he called it. He says on the other side of this gate, the sum total of human knowledge was spread out like an intellectual smorgasbord. That Hubbard really was able to see the entire world and all the knowledge and all the eons as one large tapestry easily but quickly internalized. Sounds reminiscent of the Akashic Records and brings to mind John Dee, Edgar Cayce, and even Carl Jung in the Universal Mind. There's a man named Michael Floyd I met many years ago. He's since passed on, but he told me about something called the riddle, which I want to tell you about now, but I'll have to wait. It is its own mindfuck, and I don't think you can handle all of this at once. So, back to Excalibur. The core of this book focused on the psychology of the lynch mob. It explores how and why a single human makes different decisions when standing alone and when placed among a group of people. Besides the exploration of the lynch mob mentality, it really focuses on one point. That it all comes down to one innate command inside each and every one of us. That we're simply a binary equation, on and off. One command. And that one command? Survive. Dianetics and Scientology as a whole seems to use this one concept and expand it upon it, using it as a main building block for all human mental stability and development. This comes back to our basics we discussed. Love, family, children, relationship, they're tools of survival. But back to the herd mentality and public perception. Each individual is perfectly capable of making rational decisions that are free of the bonds of society. We're born blank slates, but we're programmed from the day that we're born to accept reality as it is and not question it. The educational systems are a big part of this. They set it up so that by the time you're out in your world, your spirit has been broken, and being an outsider is frowned upon, and it's beaten into your head that it's frowned upon. It's more than frowned upon, actually. Just like Randall McMurphy was put in a nut house for his anti-authority views and seen as a danger to society in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, they try to silence the outside. It's rejected and broken over and over until it becomes something that is too big and finally breaks through. The mob mentality or the herd mentality plays both ways here. In your reality, you're surrounded by millions of people who accept the reality they've been given. To convince a million people that the sky is purple, not blue, seems insane. But stranger things have been done. If a large enough group of people fights back, then things change. This is all way too much of a gamble for the powers that be, so it's in their best interest to keep the reality perception, the big movie that they want you to act in, their matrix, alive and well. Fear is the biggest tool they have to convince us that we better just leave things alone. I have a lot of friends that, when pulled into a conversation about the NSA and spying, Edward Snowden, all the Big Brother government theories, they say, oh, my life's fine, I'm not doing anything wrong, I don't care if they're watching me. This is the biggest fail of an answer that anyone can give, because you're not thinking about what you're revealing about yourself. They may not be coming after you now, but that doesn't mean they won't be tomorrow. Just Google Martin Niemöller's famous poem, First They Came After, for a powerful message about just that. Just because they call it a crime today doesn't mean it wasn't perfectly legal yesterday. And more frighteningly, sometimes they just call things a crime for their own means. For those of you with kids or pets out there, or even older loved ones, how many times have you Googled a disease that you thought your kid or your pet or grandmother might have? How many times have you browsed porn websites or sites where questionable items might have been sold? I know everyone listening is not perfect. I'm sure some of you have figured out some of the most discreet ways to communicate with someone else without your significant other finding out. All of this data is available for viewing by other people, especially the providers of the internet. It used to be that listening over the phone was the big trick of the government, the taps and clicks you'd hear on the line. We all see it in movies, but as more and more of these things are exposed, you must realize that there are databases being set up to keep this information about you, as well as the 100,000 closest people within your proximity, you know? This is all data that's far more valuable than money or anything else. Ralph Waldo Emerson said, "There is no knowledge that is not power." Now, I don't think he meant it in this context, but damn, the shoe fits. These are tools that allow for other people, much richer people and more quote-unquote powerful people, these are the tools they use to keep you right in the box they need you to be in. To keep you in that servant file and not in the master file. As Bob Dylan said in Gotta Serve Somebody, you may be an ambassador to England or France. You may like to gamble or you may like to dance. You may be the heavyweight champion of the world. You may be a socialite with a long string of pearls. You may be a rock and roll addict prancing on the stage. You might have drugs at your command, women in a cage. You might be a businessman or some high degree thief. They may call you doctor or they may call you chief, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. It may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. It's very true. Bob Dylan always nails it right on the head. You're serving someone as we speak, and you know it. The powers that be use the media, the internet, the advertising that you see, all strategically placed and coordinated minute to minute in your daily life, and drawing the walls inside the big house we live in and painting it as a fact. The most common thing I hear after people feel they really have woken up to the bigger picture is along the lines of, now I see it everywhere. It's in the sports, it's in the news, it's in the movies, it's in the pop culture. Do you think that any one of the Kardashians is spending any time questioning the system in which they're flourishing so prominently? No, of course not. Of course they aren't. They don't want to buck the system and lose all their so-called power and wealth that they have. No one does. It's a vacuum that seriously sucks a lot harder than anything you can win on The Price is Right. And sucks even more than that bastard that's always bidding $1 higher than one of the people before him. The whole world is obsessed with the Kardashian culture. People dream of living a life like that and are instantly sucked into watching their dream unfold through the eyes of some bimbos and their insane affected parents. Now, I don't have anything against transgender people. I want everyone to be happy and free. But I don't think Caitlyn Jenner is a hero either. I don't buy it for one second. Television found a more perverted, distorted way to let the Matrix play out before our eyes, setting up new heights of success and fame and further drops into the deepest depths of despair. the destruction of humanity. But it's just like Rome, and it's just like the biblical stories of Sodom and Gomorrah. It's a cycle that plays out and has played out from the beginning of time. Power eats power, evil eats evil. It grows stronger every day. The media is a perilous device. While I love my fair share of television, it is a tool. It is a tool that builds and continues to build the myth of society's standards and continues to build wings onto the matrix that we all live in and accept. You see families on sitcoms from the 60s. It's male-driven. The wife cooks and raises the kids. The kids go through menial puzzles, dilemmas, peaks and valleys of conflict, and they provide answers that most of us can relate to solve them. These are the perceptions of reality that folks very high up who tend to have controlling shares in television networks and Hollywood film studios want to put forth. But not all films and television shows are bad. Like anything in life, it's about what you get out of something. Sometimes there are pieces of media that elicit responses that are honest and they make you think critically. One of my favorite films, no really, like number one or two, if not number one, because they usually say that Blade Runner is my favorite film of all time. But one of my favorite movies is the 1992 Phil Alden Robinson film, Sneakers, which stars Robert Redford, Dan Aykroyd, and Ben Kingsley, among others. In one of the most pivotal scenes, Ben Kingsley's character Cosmo speaks with Robert Redford's Martin Bryce.
We were going to change the world, Marty. Remember? Did you ever get around to actually doing it? No, I guess not. Well, I think I can.
Really?
Yes.
What's wrong with this country, Marty? Money, you taught me that. Evil defense contractors had it, noble causes did not. Politicians are bought and sold like so much chattel. Our problems multiply. Pollution, crime, drugs, poverty, disease, hunger, despair. We throw gobs of money at them. Problems always get worse. Why is that? Because money's most powerful ability is to allow bad people to continue doing bad things at the expense of those who don't have it.
I agree. Now, who did you say you were working for?
Oh, that's just my day job. Listen, when I was in prison, I learned that everything in this world, including money, operates not on reality, but the perception of reality.
Pause it. People think a bank might be financially shaky. Consequence?
People start to withdraw their money.
Result, pretty soon it is financially shaky.
Conclusion, you can make banks fail.
I've already done that. Maybe you've read about a few.
Think bigger.
Stock market?
Yes.
Currency market?
Yes.
Commodities market?
Yes.
Small countries?
I might even be able to crash the whole damn system. Destroy all records of ownership. Think of it, Marty. No more rich people, no more poor people. Everybody's the same. Isn't that what we said we always wanted?
Guys, you haven't gone crazy, have you?
Who else is going to change the world, Marty? Greenpeace?
You are crazy.
This quote can really apply to the plight of rogue groups like Anonymous. This is where the internet has opened the doors to so much of a tearing down of the green curtain, if you will, and revealing the Wizard of our own Oz. For years and years, the media has been such a powerful tool, keeping us right where they want us. Until the invention of the internet, only radical groups and grassroots movements have been able to even have a tiny bit of momentum in changing the world. The old squeaky wheel gets the grease. But now, real concepts are breaking through, and you can see with these political elections, the media is losing ground. It's been cast upon Google and Twitter and Facebook now to keep the perception aiming towards the system they've worked so hard to keep in place. But like I've said before, and I'll say it again, one day there will be a decentralized communication platform, social media, if you will. What a boner of a name for something, by the way, social media. Yuck. But there will be a way for all of us to speak that can't be censored, and it will be upheld via the mortality of the good people of the world. But this perception of reality is slipping from the grasps of the great overlords of evil, and I believe we're coming into a people's revolution that will one day, after many deaths and many battles, right the wrongs of our former masters and allow for everyone to be their own master. That's the point here, being your own master. There is no reality, just what we're told to see. In an article from crystallinks.com on the idea of a matrix reality, it reads, The theory that reality as we consciously experience it is not real goes back to the indigenous people who believe that we exist in a dream or illusion. In our current timeline, we refer to the matrix, grids, virtual reality, simulation, and holograms. Today, many physicists are researching the concept of the universe as a hologram, that the universe is a consciousness hologram. Reality is a projected illusion within the hologram. It is a virtual experiment created in linear time to study emotions. Our hologram is composed of grids created by a source consciousness brought into awareness by electromagnetic energy at the physical level. It is a virtual experiment created in linear time to study emotions. Our hologram is composed of grids created by a source consciousness brought into awareness by electromagnetic energy at the physical level. The hologram is created and linked through a web, or grid matrices, based on the patterns of sacred geometry. The hologram had a beginning and it has an end as consciousness evolves in the alchemy of time. As the grids collapse, everything within the hologram will end, helping to understand what is going on in the world today. In media, we find films, television shows, books, and games based on the concept of reality as a hologram. Among the more easily recognizable are The Matrix, The 13th Floor, Inception, The Holodeck, in a TV series called Star Trek, Second Life, an internet game, and The Holographic Universe, a 1991 book by Michael Talbot. The theory here takes our discussion further outside of itself to a new level of understanding. The Daily Mail reported on a philosophy lecture at the University of Notre Dame by Laura DeLimpio. In it, she explained the concept of Descartes' evil demon, updated by Gilbert Harman. In her lecture, DeLimpio said, "Consider this, right now that you are not where you think you are. In fact, you happen to be the subject of a science experiment being conducted by an evil genius. Your brain has been expertly removed from your body and is being kept alive in a vat of nutrients that sits on a laboratory bench. The nerve endings of your brain are connected to a supercomputer that feeds you all the sensations of everyday life. This is why you think you're living a completely normal life. But do you exist? Are you still even you? And is the world as you know it a figment of your imagination or an illusion constructed by an evil scientist? Yes, this sounds like the Matrix. I am aware of this, but I wanted to put that in your mind at the moment to help you consider where I am taking you." In another Daily Mail article, Abigail Beale writes, "Everything around us seems real enough, but recently a growing number of scientists have started to wonder whether life is just an incredibly sophisticated simulation. Although the debate has been raging for years, Neil deGrasse Tyson recently gathered a group of eminent scientists in an attempt to put the theory to bed, or at least discuss ways to test it. And the mathematical evidence seemingly points to the fact that our lives could be nothing more than an elaborate computer game-style existence. There are quote-unquote real scientists who consider the theory enough to meet and discuss it. That alone should merit you giving some of your cranial real estate to its consideration." We continue along with Michael Talbot in The Holographic Universe, where he relates the following about University of London physicist David Bohm, a protege of Einstein's and one of the world's most respected quantum physicists, and Carl Priebohm, a neuropsychologist at Stanford University and author of the classic neuropsychological textbook, Languages of the Brain. That was a tongue twister for me. My brain was hurting trying to get that one out. But it reads, "Only after years of dissatisfaction with standard theories' inability to explain all of the phenomena encountered in quantum physics, Priebohm became convinced, because of the failure of standard theories of the brain to explain various neuropsychological puzzles. However, after arriving at their views, Bohm and Priebohm quickly realized the holographic model explained a number of other mysteries as well, including the apparent inability of any theory, no matter how comprehensive, ever to account for all of the phenomena encountered in nature. The ability of individuals with hearing in only one ear to determine the direction from which sound originates, and our ability to recognize the face of someone who we have not seen in many years, even if that person has changed considerably in the interim. But the most staggering thing about the holographic model was that it suddenly made sense of a wide range of phenomena so elusive they generally have been categorized outside of the prevalence of scientific understanding. These include telepathy, precognition, mystical feelings of oneness with the universe, even psychokinesis, or the ability to move objects with your mind without anyone touching them. Indeed, it quickly became apparent to the ever-growing number of scientists who came to embrace the holographic model that it helped to explain virtually all paranormal and mystical experiences. And in the last half dozen years or so, it has continued to galvanize researchers and shed light on an increasing number of previously inexplicable phenomena. For example, in 1980, University of Connecticut psychologist Dr. Kenneth Fling proposed that near-death experiences could be explained by the holographic model. Ring, who is the president of the International Association for Near-Death Studies, believes such experiences, as well as death itself, are really nothing more than the shifting of a person's consciousness from one level of the hologram of reality to another. In 1985, Dr. Stanislav Grof, chief of psychiatric research at the Maryland Psychiatric Research Center, another tongue twister there for me, and an assistant professor of psychiatry at Johns Hopkins, published a book in which he had concluded that existing neuropsychological models of the brain are inadequate and that only a holographic model can explain such things as archetypal experiences, encounters with a collective unconscious, and other unusual phenomena experienced during altered states of consciousness. Now, I know that all this sounds pretty technical, and believe me, it was a mouthful, but ultimately, the point is that we don't know what the fuck is going on. I guess a science journal has to have more than one line, though, so they try to spice it up. Seriously, though, the further we dig, the less we know, and it seems to me that we're starting to know less and less at light speed. It's like Moore's Law in reverse for knowledge. Also, from the holographic universe, it tells of another researcher who is trying to understand the human brain. From the chapter called The Brain is a Hologram, Talbot writes, Canadian neurosurgeon Wilder Penfield in the 1920s had offered convincing evidence that specific memories did have specific locations in the brain. One of the most unusual features of the brain is that the object itself doesn't sense pain directly. As long as the scalp and the skull have been deadened with a local anesthetic, surgery can be performed on the brain of a fully conscious person without causing any pain. In a series of landmark experiments, Penfield used this fact to his advantage. While operating on the brains of epileptics, he would electrically stimulate various areas of the brain cells. To his amazement, he found that when he stimulated the temporal lobes, the region of the brain behind the temples, of one of his fully conscious patients, they re-experience memories of past episodes from their lives in vivid detail. One man suddenly relived a conversation he had with friends in South Africa. A boy heard his mother talking on a telephone and after several touches from Penfield's electrodes was able to repeat her entire conversation. A woman found herself in her kitchen and could hear her son playing outside. Even when Penfield tried to mislead his patients by telling them that he was stimulating different areas when he was not, he found that when he touched the same spot, it always evoked the same memory. In his book, The Mystery of the Mind, published in 1975, just shortly before his death, he wrote, "It was evident at once that these were not dreams. They were electrical activations of the sequential record of consciousness, a record that has been laid down during the patient's earlier experience. The patient relived all that he had been aware of in that early period of time as a moving picture flashback." From his research, Penfield concluded that everything we've ever experienced is recorded in our brain. From every stranger's face we have glanced at in a crowd to every spider web we gazed at as a child. Imagine if we could access these things. It could be amazing to see the loved ones we lost and relive great times we had when we were younger, but it could be even more dangerous. Like a drug to those who got hooked on living in the past, or even more scary, like a tool for thought police to abuse. Some creeps in black suits taking you in for questioning, and then they ask you nothing. They just hook up an electrode. The whole idea is much like the Robin Williams movie, The Final Cut. This concept also reminds me of a story I heard David Icke tell on the cross-country trip I keep talking about throughout the series. He told a story of a man named Tom who had been hypnotized. Tom had come to the hypnotist's office with his daughter, and the hypnotist had told Tom while he was under suggestion there in the office chair, that he would not be able to see his daughter in the room once he opened his eyes. Once Tom was snapped out of his state of suggestion there, he was asked what he saw in the room. He only saw the room and the hypnotist. He didn't see his daughter. She was invisible to him. To push this point further, the hypnotist told Tom's daughter to stand in front of her father, and the hypnotist held a watch behind her back, a wristwatch. And then he asked Tom to identify the object that he was holding, which was blocked by Tom's daughter's body. Tom then said without a pause, "A watch." So how does one explain this while trying to defend the reality that we've all perceived as rock solid? Is our brain itself just a computer that controls how we experience the world around us? Is it receiving information through the pineal gland, like the third eye, like some speculate? Is it something related to quantum entanglement and information being communicated between distant particles? The Ganzfeld experiment is an experiment that is said to test ESP in individuals. But it also shows how the brain reacts when it has limited input. The idea is the receiver is put in a comfortable chair with halved ping pong balls over their eyes with a red light shining on them, and the receiver also wears a pair of headphones in which white noise or static, like, is played pretty loud. The receiver is then made to stay in this sensory deprivation state for about 30 minutes. At the same time, there's a sender who's looking at several random items in another room or images and tries to communicate them telepathically to the person who's wearing the headphones, the receiver. And as this happens, the receiver speaks out loud during the 30-minute period, and this is recorded. Afterwards, they show four or five different things to the receiver, one of which was being communicated to them by the sender. There'll be like three or four decoys around it right there, and so they want them to pick which thing the person was looking at. And in many cases, the receiver was right, but it was often what the brain communicated during that 30-minute session that was more interesting. The brain literally created trips and images, thoughts and feelings that were almost like a negative reaction to the sensory deprivation. Colors, images, flashbacks, movies, hearing the voices of dead relatives, traveling to other places. Much like astral planing, as they call it, the concept of meditation and interdimensional travel has always had a large following. Many people claim to be able to fly across the world in higher states and even view other people in other places to later be proven right. If you think that sounds like a bunch of New Age mumbo-jumbo, then look up the Stargate Project that U.S. Army established in the 1970s and thought enough of it to keep it open until 1995. This all supports the theory of reality being a programmed matrix or a hologram, a mass of data being sent to our computer, whether it's actually right in front of us or not. The thought that we're living in something that is merely a simulation or even more hopeful, just one current plane of reality, is pretty mind-blowing. I love my Cheerios. I love my Nintendo games. I saw Guns N' Roses in 2001 and New Year's Eve in Las Vegas, the show with Buckethead. To think that Buckethead is just some part of a big video game that's being programmed to farm my body out as a giant battery just doesn't seem right. But it definitely could be real. If there truly are infinite number of universes like the multiverse theory says, I'm glad I ended up being in this one, in this space, at this time, with those I love around me. And it's hard to imagine being anywhere else. If I'm really just a big energizer plugged into some sentient machine or an alien's iPod charger, then certainly this episode and all the future and past episodes of Beyond the Black do not matter. I mean, if that's the case, then why am I not just a junkie, just kicking it around? Because of love. And I don't mean to get, you know, too sanctimonious with all this, but it is because of love, because I love my wife and I love my kids and I love my producer. Because love is real. Even if we're just in some simulation, love is still real. It's the best thing you can do with your life. And I'm beginning to feel like a hippie or something with all this love, 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 peace stuff. But it's true. You can't let this whole thing get to you. It's not real. Even if it is, to some degree, infinite love is the only truth and everything else is illusion. Which brings me to how I want to end this episode. God bless Alabama. There's a diamond in this city. That cuts through valleys and gray skies, even through days of darkness, there's always a ray of light. God bless Alabama, wild warrior rose. She's got some angels watching out. My daughter, Alabama, was born on November 28, 2007. She's almost 9 now, and my son, Blackjack, is 5. This song was written for Alabama by my childhood best friend, Matt Reeser. He's her godfather, and he wrote it late night in New York City on the eve of her birth. My children are the best part of me. They've taught me more than any book or any scholar has ever come close to. The only dilemma is that Blackjack is jealous that he doesn't have a song on an album with his name in it, so I got a tall order writing something as meaningful and kind as this song. But I want to wind down this way heavy discussion about how the evils in the world are keeping us boxed into this matrix of society. Simulation or not, Alabama is the light always shining in my universe, and so is Blackjack. But Alabama is the focus of this song. I see her every day looking at the world through innocent, hopeful eyes, always finding the beauty, always lighting the way. It's inspiring. It keeps me going, and it makes me feel like there really is hope in the world. She's not caught up in the matrix and the boxes. She's creative, and she's smart, and she's paving her own way. So is my little boy, but he's definitely young and still shit-kicking every day, you know? But finding that light, having something to remind you that it's not as hard as it seems, can be the thing that keeps you going. It's not all bad. Like I said, go outside and you'll see so much beauty and happiness. Stay away from the media. Stay away from the news. Stay away from too much social media. Listen to John Prine and blow up your TV. Fear is that powerful of a tool. They use it every day. They want you to be afraid to go outside. They want you to be afraid to push the boundaries and break the rules. They want you to be afraid of becoming poor and dying. So they keep you obedient. Find the beauty. Find the heart. Look to someone close to you and find a little love and run with it. Have a great time being with each other, listening to great music, and the art of the great minds that inspire you to be what you really know you have inside. We're all masters. We are all powerful. We are all knowing. All you have to do is follow your heart and give more love than you take. I always like hearing from you guys, so please write me over at shooter@beyondthe.black and tell me your stories. If you have something to add to the topics I'm talking about, I want to hear about it. If you've had experiences that you want to share, write me, and I promise that we'll get into what you guys have been saying during this series. I've got to say, I'm really grateful for you guys and for all the listens we've got right off the bat for Beyond the Black. I know ultimately that one of our goals is trying to sell the Black Ribbons Ultimate Edition coming out on November 8th, 2016. A shameless plug, of course. But shilling the record is not the basis of the show. It's really been a journey for me as much as for you guys, and it's something that I've always wanted to do. So now we're doing it, and it feels like freedom. So I want to thank every one of you who continues to trust me enough with your time as we travel the roads less traveled beyond the black. Beyond the Black was written and produced by Shooter Jennings and Brad Jewell and is a production of Black Country Rock Los Angeles in association with J&J Productions. Until next episode, there are many roads to follow. The only safe one is the truth.
There are many roads to follow. The only safe one is the truth. God bless Alabama. Wild on the roads.
Insecure transmission. Stay tuned for future messages. Everything is illusion.